All right, you are listening to the Canadian Asian Missional Podcast. Oh man, we're really excited. For those of you guys who've been regularly listening, you guys have heard us mention David Fitch a lot of times, and we got him here in the flesh. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, but we can't hear each other talk. It's so loud in here.
But you know what?
We're here together in the flesh, we can't hear a thing about what anybody's saying.
We need the Holy Spirit to inspire.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That was Bernard, the Christian Missionary Alliance guy. He believes in the Holy Spirit. Amen?
Amen to that.
Healing, amen. All that stuff.
Oh, man, we're the A-team, right?
Is it the Bible? Bernard is here, Shu is here, and David Fitch is here. Do you want to introduce yourself quickly?
Myself, David Fitch from Chicago, from Northern Seminary, and I'm a pastor at Peace of Christ. I almost said Life in the Vine, but Peace of Christ Church in Westmont, Illinois, and an inner southwest suburb of Chicago. Great place. Drop by anytime. We're right down the main drag.
Awesome. So, as a Canadian Asian Missional Podcast, we're going to ask you some burning questions we've been wanting to ask you for a while and just get your take on these questions. So, the three of us put these all together. I know Shu is a Fitchite.
Shu is a Fitchite?
Fitchite.
He's
Fitchite. I'm a Shuite.
Shuite.
That's biblical. I don't know.
All right.
Let's not confuse Shiite with Shuite.
It's going to be good. All right. I think you're going to start this all off.
I don't know. There's some weird question here because I didn't write this down, but how do you feel as a white man being interviewed by the Canadian Asian Missional Podcast? I don't know. That's one of these guys, not me.
You know, if you hadn't have actually said anything about it, I wouldn't have even been aware. That I'm the only white man in the room. Why? Because us white people always assume everybody's just like us until you point it out to
us. I don't know. I think we're the three Asians in the room.
We're the three Asians in this room. We are clearly the minority now.
Yeah. I think you are right. Now, I got to say that the issue of ethnicity, culture, race in Canada is different. I believe, at least. I'm not up here enough to know for sure, but I believe it's different than in the United States. Hmm. We have a long litany of antagonistic historical stories going on having to do with slavery, having to do with Jim Crow, having to do with white privilege. Well, it's not even white privilege. It's white supremacy. And so there's a hostile antagonism and a lot of stuff going on that needs to be unwound for God to do his work in the United States. Now, I know Canada has similar histories, especially maybe with the Native Canadian First Nations peoples, etc. But I believe it's been a much more, by definition, you tell me, immigrant country. No? I mean, we in the United States say we're an immigrant country. But as anyone who's paid attention to the politics of the United States in the last, 18 months... you know that there's something going on there that's not yet explicit and been dealt with. How is it up here, the history of cultural relation, ethnic relations here in Canada? Go ahead. I'm listening.
Ah, that's a big question.
I think discrimination and the hardship were a lot of the history. Like, even the Chinese people, when they first came, during the Gold Rush, when they came to the West, in B.C., there's a huge amount of discrimination and prejudice. There's a head tax for Chinese people that came. But I think over the years, it has softened a little bit.
Huh.
And immigration-wise, I think it's only really the major cities that has the mass immigrations.
Vancouver, Montreal,
Toronto, Ottawa, some of the other cities that are kind of growing are becoming more, like Calgary. But I would say it's
Doesn't
more like...
Doesn't Winnipeg have some large immigrant populations there, too?
There's a large Chinese population.
Well, yeah. And that was, Pierre Trudeau, right? Bringing in...
opening it up?
Yeah, prairies, getting the other immigrants to go to the prairies, giving them a bit more benefits here and there like that. Trying to attract them in that area at that time. So... I think Canada in general, there is a bit more open and a bit more in terms of inclusive is, a terminology that even the current Trudeau would use, you know, yeah. stuff like that. And I at least in terms of immigration, in terms of bringing people of different ethnicity.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
and you can even see it in like, in kind of like the political parties, like the new NDP leader is an East Indian man, right? It's like, it's changing. The face of Canada is changing.
Yeah.
It's so different than when I grew up here in the 60s and 70s. It was basically a white nation with some minorities, much like the United States, but it does not feel that way at all now. It feels like I am, and I only hang in the cities that you're talking about, but I feel like I'm very much not the majority when I walk into Toronto or I walk down the streets of Toronto. I being a white male.
That's only really Toronto. If you leave the GTA, if you leave kind of the cities, like there's like it's still predominantly Caucasian, right? Like the kind
really?
Of smaller towns, smaller yep. cities.
The really? Rural sure. towns yeah. are very much like that.
Yeah, very much so. And in fact, like, you know, going up north just to go to like maybe a cottage or anything, you're going to cross by towns that are just like we would be sticking out crazy.
Yeah.
And like someone who's Caucasian would just blend in to kind of the environment, right?
But it's just because the urban centers are still the place where that, you know, where the power,
yeah.
where the opportunities, but I'll say the power, where the power is, where people are, I don't know, yeah, they're coming to.
Yeah.
Main place.
For sure. I think even a lot of the churches in those areas are still predominantly white, you know, kind of the WASP kind of.
For sure.
Yeah.
But like in Toronto, the bigger churches are the ethnic churches.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Like the growing, vibrant churches are the ethnic ones.
And that's an interesting tension, just to be like, okay, in this inner cities, you see these churches explode, but they're all immigrant churches or ethnic churches. But then, like, in the rest of Canada, outside the cities, it's still very kind of white Canadian. I'm just also just,
oh, for sure.
yeah.
I agree.
Making observations.
I would agree with that
assessment. So we all have much work to do, is what you're saying.
And there's still lots of work to do.
And there's still, like, sprinklings of people of different ethnicity in those areas, and smaller churches start there. Like even my church plants out smaller churches, like plants out people, sends out missionary planters out there into like just Barrie, right? Like just
really?
A little bit more north, and it's just like a congregation of 50 Chinese people that just kind of huddled together. You know?
I think that's part of the diasporic movement, like the ethnic diasporas that are moving around, and I think that same philosophy is, you know, happening in like the rural areas, like she was describing. Like churches in the city hubs would be like, oh, like we have a bunch of Asians in like, you know, like Thunder Bay, so
yeah.
let's kind of go plant the church there
yeah.
for the 25 people that are there. So it's kind of like this diasporic way of doing mission.
I believe that that's the way the gospel spread, through immigration, not through sending individual missionaries to other places.
Mm.
Immigration's been and the diaspora of the first, the nation of Israel, was the groundwork for mission, the first mission. I think we ought to keep doing that. But, of course, it takes an imagination for the Gentiles, the Jews, to come together and for God to do this new thing. And that, until we do that new thing, it's just a segregated little club
yeah.
until we do the new thing.
Missional theology of migration.
Yeah. And even though I have to be careful when I mention the name John Howard Yoder, but in his, because he's got issues now that we all know about, the theology of mission, he has a whole chapter on immigration and mission and how this is the history of mission from the New Testament on, so actually from the Old Testament on. So I think you all have an amazing opportunity in the things that you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Okay, we're going to jump into some of these questions. And we got to say, first of all, when we first met David Fitch, which was a number of years ago, it was at a pub. We are once again at a pub, Hair of the Dog pub.
He sure hangs out at pubs a lot, doesn't that? Doesn't
hey,
that guy
we
Fitch?
We just happened to bump into him here. And we're just
it's
like,
a Canadian thing.
It's a Canadian thing, yeah. That's who we are. We the North? Maybe. All right, so very quick question, just to kind of, oh, you have a Canadian flag as your iPhone case.
It's yeah. impressive.
My wife did that.
Yes.
To help.
Kind of warmed my heart that she did that.
Does that help you get across the border?
I just wave
that around?
You know, back when my mom was from Chicago, and so we traveled back from Hamilton to Chicago every Christmas and every summer, and my dad used to put a Bible on the thing at the border. And, you know, so that they would trust us more. And actually, he got convicted of that, and he wouldn't do it anymore. But in place of the Bible, I put this.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And then you switch it to the American flag when you come back. Yeah.
Wait. Do you have another case?
I don't have a case of an American flag.
That would be amazing.
You just hide the phone when you go back.
I don't have problems getting back in. It's problems getting across the first time.
All right. So our first kind of big question is, you know, there are so many different missional thinkers out there. What do you feel differentiates your approach than others?
Well, you can look up in the Journal of Missiology, October 2000, I think it was 3 years ago.
That's quotable right there.
Missional, the Other Conversation by me. And I argue that there's got to be a place for the Anabaptist track, the Radical Reformation, to understand mission in post-Christendom. So I think that I don't know that there's anybody actually doing that in the missional world. If we can call, excuse me, folks, that was an ill-timed belch from that,
the Canadian from light beer, man.
Light beer.
Canadian
light
lager.
Light Canadian beer, man.
But I don't know if there's anybody else doing that Anabaptist thing, and I think it's actually the very, very important, if I could even say most important, to understand church and culture from an Anabaptist perspective when we're no longer in power. It seems to me that would be the first place we go, is first understanding Christians as a minority people in the New Testament, and then understanding the Anabaptists as they were getting, you know, beat up by the Reformed and the Catholics, and becoming a persecuted minority in Europe. And basically the approach of being a minority people, an alternative society, a contrast culture that we can then engage the culture. I think that's essential to understanding missionary work in post-Christendom.
Who would you say are some of the practitioners of that right now? I know you said that there weren't a whole lot, but... Are there
practitioners of that?
Of the Anabaptists?
I think anybody who does neo-monasticism, although there's a lot of people there that could use a little more theology, if you ask me. there's Chris Smith and John Pattison and the Slow Church movement that have a lot of that vibe. CCDA and the 3 R's by John Perkins has a lot of that vibe. Wendell Berry. I don't know if he's a church or not, but he's got a lot of stuff he's written about being a community in the world.
Good poetry.
Yeah.
Amazing poetry.
So what's interesting for, I think, even where I came from, I think from influence theologically, coming more from at least in my Chinese church context, a lot more kind of reform thinking, a lot more typical evangelical, reformed evangelical. What is different from the Anabaptist approach than to the reformed guys? Because the people who are listening, I think they understand the typical evangelical way of approach, but what's the difference, you know, that you would say?
Like the distinctiveness?
Yeah, distinctives.
Yeah.
Distinctives.
Okay, one distinctive is we see God... and the way he works, and he doesn't work through coercive means, nonviolent presence. And therefore, we have to go out and be present to what God's doing. I think that's a harder thing for Reformed people to get. If you're listening, Reformed persons, if you see God as sovereign, angry, and controlling and predestining everything, you have a harder time understanding that God's at work in the world. So you need to read Greg Boyd, Crucifixion of the Warrior God. Get an understanding of how God works through his presence in the world. How he, take this word very carefully now, how he condescends and enters into the world through Jesus Christ. and becomes present in the suffering and the hurt of the world and takes it somewhere towards redemption. So that's a big difference, I think, between Reformed theology and Anabaptist theology. We see salvation is primarily an issue of kingdom and lordship of Christ versus forgiveness of sins transaction. I shall be saved and not receive the wrath of God, and I shall go to heaven when I die. Now, I want to be clear that all that still happens in one way, shape, or another, but the dominant metaphor of understanding how we enter the kingdom is through submitting to Jesus as Lord of our lives and Lord of our circumstances and Lord of our homes and Lord of our neighborhoods and Lord of our jobs and our money and everything. The primary entry point isn't, oh, cha-ching, I get this ticket out of hell. That is part of salvation if we submit that part of our lives to God, and we all need forgiveness to enter into the presence of Christ.
Hmm.
But that's not first. Like Holzclaw says, the relationship is about lordship. The sin issue is about maintaining the relationship. So if you don't have the relationship, what good is maintaining or dealing with sin? So sin is more about the things I've done to injure our relationship, the things I've done to injure other relationships. I must make them right. It's not like a conceptual transaction in the sky somewhere where a judge is sitting with a gavel and goes, boom, you're forgiven, although there's a piece of truth there.
Okay.
But it doesn't get, it puts too much priority on that. And so, and by the way, the Old Testament isn't like that either. Forgiveness of sins, the Lamb, the purity, the slain Lamb is all about giving my life and surrendering it to God to enter into His presence. The purity and cleansing of my life, not the receipt, not the substitution, to take the wrath of God, propitiation.
Right.
The hysteria, you probably know this because we've been talking about it a lot on our Facebook pages and everything. And Holzclaw is the systematic theology between the two of us. Theology on Mission is our podcast. Holzclaw talks about it a lot. He talks a lot on the podcast.
I think you guys got a good dialogue going. You guys bounce off each other, and you guys, and the most important,
I've been with that guy for 20 years.
The most important thing, you guys have fun doing it, right?
We do. Yeah. We do. And Holzclaw knows how to handle me. I'm getting kind of old and senile, and Holzclaw knows how to handle me.
I like what some of the e-books that he's writing. I'll pitch him right now that he's writing some really good, pithy kind of e-books.
Like he
people.
Just did this e-book email course that he teaches at Northern.
Yeah.
What is it? What was it?
It was like the reasons why Jesus died. It was kind of over Easter.
Yeah,
he only talked about forgiveness as one of them, and then it was like there was three other things.
Write him at Northern Seminary off of his email on the Northern Seminary website and ask him for it, because I just asked him for that very same thing at our church for a bunch of people that are in the conversation, so it's good stuff.
Nice.
Another book to read that every Reformed person will roll their eyes the back of their heads as soon as I say it is The Day the Revolution Began by N.T. Wright.
N.T. Wright.
That, by the way, does not dismiss substitutionary atonement. It just places it within the whole rubric of understanding how we are born to be in the presence and lordship of God and His kingdom.
But I wouldn't say you dismiss it. You're not dismissing substitutionary atonement. You are also giving a bigger picture of the gospel, right?
The bigger picture is so important. I'm actually talking about this Sunday morning at Timothy Eaton Church.
By the time this airs, he'll have gone.
Yeah, like
David Fitch will be back in the States,
but
unfortunately. So I'm sorry for those who are showing up at the church.
If they're recording it, you can probably hear it.
That's right. If they have recorded David Fitch preaching or speaking, then go to their website and you can hear more about that.
Yeah, but anyways, I just want to say this is a really important thing for me. I think in my sermon, and since no one's going to actually go to the website and listen to my sermon, I think I talk about a dentist having a nightmare of going to a dentist. I don't know how you are in terms of dentists, but I'm very suspicious of dentists. I can handle politicians. I can handle lawyers, but I cannot handle a dentist. And I have a nightmare that, like, I go into a dentist's office and he does five fillings. And I go, what was that all about? And he goes, I came in for just a cleaning. He says, I know, but I don't do cleanings. I only do cavities. Yeah. So I did five of them on you. I hope you don't mind. And the illustration is that a lot of times we come to people because we only know one view of salvation, and we don't give the person, we don't offer the person the gospel that they need, that meets their need, because we shrunk the gospel down to this very narrow space. Where you must be guilty. You are going to hell. You are receiving the wrath of God. And by that point, the person's going, this is scaring the hell out of me. I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
But one time in 100, somebody's going to say, oh, yes.
That's exactly
give me
what
the
I
gospel.
Needed to hear. Yeah, for sure.
Okay, and that was the one time you should have said it, not the other 99.
You know what I find, honestly, though? If I were to be honest, even in my congregation, I don't even think they're even comfortable sharing the gospel, proclaiming that,
well,
even that
Shu did an unbelievable dissertation, by the way. I've been going through dissertations this last month. I don't want to mention any names because you know them. They haven't been up to snuff. They haven't met the expectations of Shu's work. But he did a whole exploration of the gospel in his church and how it's not connecting with people outside the four walls of that building.
Yeah. I just want to remind our listeners that David Fitch's opinions are not the opinions of the larger podcast. Just to clarify that, in case we are losing listeners by
just
the minute.
Just to clarify for anybody from the churches that employ these guys.
just a caveat.
You're not listening,
Fitch's
right?
Opinion.
Not
listening.
Guys not listening.
Oh my goodness. We're toast. All right, Bernard, do you want to...
You know,
you
if you were all Christian Missionary Alliance like Bernard and I, you'd know there's a fourfold gospel, not just a onefold gospel. Is
there
that right,
go.
Bernard?
Yeah,
there you go.
Preach it!
I had to do a lot of that during my ordination, so...
All right.
I like CMA stuff, man.
Good.
I'd be down with it.
So now let's get back to the Canadian Asian idea. I guess like American Asian, because you... might have worked with a lot more American Asians. Like this idea of mutual submission is huge in what you have spoken about and you've written about. Like, what does that look like in a patriarchal, hierarchical kind of system? And how do you work with, encourage?
Which I think is a lot of our context, right?
Yeah.
Across the board, Asian churches are in that kind of model, right?
Yeah.
Chinese, Japanese, Korean...
I just taught on APIS leadership, like the fivefold giftings, a couple weeks ago. And I was like mapping out what church kind of looks like in its hierarchical order, and then pushing people to think like, what if it doesn't have to look like that? And I think a lot of people are like, oh, I have never seen church any other way.
That's true. So like, we're getting back to mutual submission, leadership. What are your thoughts?
Non-coercive,
folks, non-violent.
Let's try to understand. One basic thing. The church has been in power in the West for a long, long time. And to the extent that Asian people were influenced, were enculturated to church through the West, hierarchy will always be there. Now, it's not... Don't take me too far, because I know hierarchy exists outside of Christendom as well. Because wherever God and His presence are no longer needed, we resort to hierarchy. We resort to efficiency.
That's a big word.
Yeah.
And it works, by the way, when you have a Christian culture and you don't have to... nobody needs to get saved anymore, and we don't need to solve problems anymore. We just tell people what to do, and they do it. But when we're in a post-Christian world and in mission, I mean, I can't go outside down Cass Avenue and start telling people what to do because the Bible says so, or because I'm an ordained clergyman of the Christian Missionary Alliance. You better listen to me, or else you're going to go to hell. Nobody cares. No, there has to be, and furthermore, there has to be a relationality to the church, not a top-down dictatorship, even if it's very nice and coercive. I don't know if any of your listeners have been paying attention to Bill Hybels and the mess down at Barrington, Illinois, in my neck of the woods. But, and I better be careful what I say.
No, you don't have to. You can say whatever you want
on this
podcast.
Well, I just want to say, I actually know so much about the situation. But what I want to say is the problem isn't did Bill Hybels cheat on his wife? Did Bill Hybels commit adultery? He didn't. The problem is the culture of leadership there where you distance yourself from people, you posture yourself over people, and then you teach other people to be leaders just like you, and now you have posturing against posturing. And you have women who learned how to be leaders like men, and you have a war going on, not only within the leadership, but former leaders are coming back.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to do things in mutuality and sort out their problems. That's not just the persons whose names shall not be mentioned coming and accusing Bill, but that's Bill's problem because he never opened up that space to begin with because he operated out of a posture of U.S. business, hierarchy, leadership, I'm in charge, I'm the one who will tell you how to solve this problem. Hmm. And until we get out of that, we're only gonna create organizations that gather already existing Christians that already listen to the leader. We're not going to relationally engage and create something new for what God's doing in the world.
Oh.
I think people are so afraid of the messiness, or they think that will cause. Like, because like you said, there's an order that you could just sort of snap your finger and the hierarchy will just kind of make it work. Or and then even like thinking about what you're saying in terms of the Western or European influence, I think that's in anything. In for example, in the Chinese church, just confirmed in Chinese church leaders that you can just take that approach of hierarchy. And that is just natural. Now it's just confirming this stuff. It's already part of our culture. Now it's just part of it. And then, you know, it just continues it on. It just eggs it on.
And so here's what you need to do. You need to preach again and again and again what Jesus does whenever his disciples pull the hierarchy card. And they're always saying, who's going to sit on the right? Who's going to sit on the left? Who's going to get to tell everybody what to do? And Jesus gets frustrated every time. I think it happens 5 times. He says something like, oh, you stupid people.
He says, that was not edited out, by the way. That's just
that's
how
that's the
David
way the Gentiles, meaning those outside of God, do. That's they lord it over, but it shall not be so among us.
Yeah.
And those who want to lead shall serve. And there's a mutuality that he points to around the table, actually, in Luke 22 when he's going off on this speech. He goes off on that speech time after time after time. You know, what you need to understand is that the Jews wanted a king. Jesus, God had given the nation of Israel priests, prophets, judges, and a college of leadership, a polycentric way of leading. And they said, we don't want that anymore. We're tired of the messiness of this. We want a king, like the Gentiles do. And God says, oh, give him, says to Samuel, oh, go ahead and give him a king. But tell him it's not going to work out too good. We need to realize this isn't the way God's going to work to change the world. So we need to call people to this. And I believe it is us as sinners wanting to default to the way of not depending upon God. And this is where the culture is going to change. And right now, I just know millennial after millennial who says, I'm tired of the authoritarian, disauthentic leadership. I'm just tired. I'm out.
Hmm.
And they're looking for authentic table leadership, organically driven around the tables in the neighborhoods. So, granted, it's a revolution. It's a revolution.
Do you think that that's more for millennials across the board or like Christian millennials? Because I found a lot of my contacts that Christian millennials still turn to this more kind of hierarchical model. like I feel like they feel a comfort in like being in this space.
Hmm.
And it's almost like their imagination has been sapped and they just can't imagine out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it doesn't surprise me that, you know, in the States we call it the Mark Driscoll effect, right? A very strong, male-dominated, hierarchical, I'm going to tell you what to do, leadership. Of course, it always blows up just like Mark Driscoll blew up.
Right.
But there are people who don't have sufficient faith and trust, and they want control. That's, again, that's the opposite of trusting and living in the presence of God. Unfortunately, there are people who want to do that. Fine. But that's not where the revolution is going to begin. Of course, we all know the story of Vietnam. Christian Missionary Alliance leaves in 1975 at the fall of Saigon. A lot of those people came to Canada, started this Vietnamese district here in Canada. But we had 37,000 people in our church in 1975. They went back 10 years ago. They found 785,000 and growing. Why? Because it was distributed, local, communal, non-hierarchical, vibrant community.
I think they're their own denomination now, right? Is that
in Vietnam?
In Vietnam.
Could be.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not saying everything's beautiful and there's no conflict and all everything, blah, blah. No, of course there is. That's part of what it means to be the people of God is to sort that out together
in
mutuality of the Spirit.
Continuing on in this conversation, and you were talking about, like, how do we work this out together? How do we learn to mutually submit together? And, of course, we've talked a lot about modeling on our podcast a lot, about we need to start doing it ourselves and then be able to lead or walk alongside others in doing it. And, you know, I want to ask, you know, what are the ways in which you've kind of taken steps? What are the ways you've communicated it? And I'm kind of relating this back to actually a Facebook post that you put up recently where you talked a lot about how often my goal...
This Fitch versus Fitch? Are we like, taking it? We're doing Coleslaw here.
Coleslaw, I'm stealing your thing. I'm sorry.
John is Coleslaw.
I'm obviously not Jeff Coleslaw. All right. You said, often my goal is simply to disrupt the prevailing ideology, unspoken, and at work. In the process, people may get pissed. But this was not my goal. My goal should always be to open up space for the kingdom. So how do you communicate this in a way that people can hopefully receive it and respond to it and hopefully take those steps together?
Yeah, so by its very nature, polycentric, charismatic, gift-oriented leadership, where you allow women to be mutually partners with men in ministry is by its very nature disruptive.
Yes.
It's by its very nature.
Sure.
I wish Che Guevara hadn't been a violent man, but that's Che Guevara kind of leadership.
Sure.
On the ground, grassroots, disruptive leadership that's going to talk about things that the people up there don't want you to talk about. But everybody wants to talk about them. We got to talk about them. We got to figure out where Jesus is, what he's doing in this situation. That's where the whole sexuality crisis came from.
Right.
The higher-ups didn't know what to say, so they didn't allow you to talk about it. Now we got a whole bunch of people that grew up not being able to talk about it.
Yeah.
And finally, when they did, they had other people leading the conversation that didn't lead them into the present. Well, I'm not. I better watch what I say right now. But anyways... The whole point is, yeah, we got to start somewhere. So I've always started by Life on the Vine, I was the one church planter, but I said to the district superintendent, I'm not going to be the only pastor here. I don't believe in that. So I took the pittance of money I got to start the church. You know, I got 3 years of salary that didn't pay one-third of my costs. I took that. I said, I'm going to keep my job and split that between two other people. That immediately set in motion a tripod of leadership. I believe you got to have at least three to start a church. When people would say, who's the senior pastor? I would say, no one. We don't have a senior pastor. What? How can I know what kind of church that is? I says, that's exactly what I want you to say.
Sure.
This is a church not led by one leader. There's the preacher. There's the evangelist. There's the pastor. There's the prophet. There's the person you're going to go to when you have needs, pastoral. There's the person you're going to go to sort out issues in scripture, etc. And I think that sets into motion how those people are co-leading, but also being an example of how we handle conflict together sets into motion the rest of the leaders.
Right.
So I would say their first gifts, like 1 Corinthians 12, it says first apostles, then prophets, then teachers, then the rest of the gifts. The then comes after the three.
Hmm.
Likewise in Ephesians 4. So it's our job to go find other gifted people and to affirm them and encourage them in their various neighborhoods, to order communities in their neighborhoods. And this sets off into motion all this leadership.
Sure.
We don't have to do everything anymore. In fact, I'm one of four pastors right now. I work less as a pastor than I ever have in our church. And we have a small church plant that has a lot of work.
Sure.
Does that help give a
idea of how
we go about it?
And I think you touch a lot of even giving up power too, right? Being able to give up power and in our leadership, and that's huge. I mean, like, to quote Princess Bride, inconceivable for a lot of Asian churches. They can't even imagine what does that mean when a person is not in power leading the church, but is able to give up power and also encourage and to build up and invest into others and to identify in others their leadership, right?
Oh, dude.
A lot of times giving up power looks like more giving up control and the outcome.
Yeah.
Like and if you're the pastor, you need to control that outcome and the thing, the goal that we set, the one. Right? Like, and I think that's what's kind of happening.
That is so essential to leadership in the new day and the new age we're facing. We're just going to reproduce what we've already done.
Mm.
We don't need to do this. But we are facing, I was just thinking, driving here, I was thinking about all the ways I used to think and experience Christianity when I was a boy in the 60s and 70s, and how completely, totally different it is today, and how we need to be able to engage, but it's not, we can't figure that out before we do it, and we empower people to engage and discern. So this is the... That point about giving up control is so important. But I'll just say one more thing.
Yeah.
I may have given up control, but all those leaders in the past, you know, Life in the Vine and other churches. But my goodness, I get calls from people telling me, hey, I just want you to know, I've been impacted by so-and-so and so-and-so in my life. And they attribute the time they spent with you and under your ministry is learning how to do this, and I just want to thank you. And I'm on the floor bawling my eyes out, praising God that I was so privileged to be able to spur on other leaders into the kingdom.
That's so amazing. That's
the best experience I think a leader can have.
Yeah, wow.
Something popped into my head when I think, at least I feel in this situation, I'm pretty sure John does too, but he's just started at a new church, actually. But Bernard doesn't because he leads his church. But okay, just in mutual submission.
Mutual
submission, yes. Of course.
We also have three pastors.
Yes.
In a church.
Oh, that's true.
And they all talk about this. David Fitch's head just blew up.
Christian Missionary Alliance, too.
His mind just got blown.
Hallelujah, man. We got to all go there. But
I don't know.
So we're learning. What do you suggest? And I know, you know, you're not living in our context. You're not seeing what's going on. But in general, if people are listening and they're in, like, the word middle management of the church, middle leadership, because it's great to think through starting something like that, you know, from the ground up, having, you know, creating that leadership structure that's a different way than what we've done before. How do you start impacting things from a kind of middle place or even, like, associate place or whatever language?
Interesting, because like I think I've always struggled with this, even in my old church, because I was a youth college pastor before I went to church planting, and part of my wrestling was like, why am I the only one that's trying to give voice to everything, and that's not what it's supposed to be, and maybe part of the response, and I don't mean to just take over, but but I wonder if just like wherever we're influencing, we practice this posture, like wherever we have the areas and the spaces that we are able to place in, whatever kind of influences God has placed us, like we practice it. You know, we bring other people into it. Like, we don't just be the driving force behind everything. And we just kind of, like, almost subversively submit the control to other people that are part of, like, our co-laborers.
Yeah, unfortunately, most people raised in church do not know how to participate in leadership of the church. Even people brought into so-called eldership status think they're there to support the pastor. I'll say, well, we'll sit around and we'll do the gift inventory in the back of Mike Breen's building discipleship culture. It's about 75 questions, and it gives you a score, and we'll talk about our giftedness, and we'll learn, and then we'll be in the middle of an issue. Let's say, how are we going to reach out to this apartment building on Cass Avenue that's having major race issues in the parking lot on summer nights, summer of 2012. Okay, I'll say, well, we have Judy there, and we have a couple other people there. Why don't we just go be there, and let's support her by sending so-and-so, and I'll put that out there. I'll say, what do you think about that, so-and-so? You're the pastor. What do you think about that, so-and-so? You're the prophet. Well, she's going to need more help than that, or she's... Well, what do you mean she's going to... And we'll have a discussion, and the gifts will participate in the issue, and we'll come to a coalescence. But somebody's got to make a proposal and then submit it to the rest of the group. There'll be times when we have an issue, and the pastor brings the proposal, and I'll say, you know, so-and-so, I need you to make a proposal so we can discuss it. You got to lead. This is not bitch leading here. What's the proposal? And then I, as an apostle evangelist, will make my comments. Together, we'll buy in and we'll go do it. You need to learn how to do that, because most people are passive aggressive. Either I'm leading or I'm not. And it's really not like that. It's, I make a proposal, I submit to you, what do you think? And then together we coalesce around it. I like it, but maybe we could do A plus B, and then someone says, yeah, but B needs to be changed to C, and before we're done, it's A and C. And
maybe F.
And, and F, and we together craft, and we go, it seems good to us in the Holy Spirit to go forward on this, and we could do it, and we're all in it together, and we present it to the congregation, and it makes a lot of sense.
It's like a
but that kind
way.
Of leadership
yeah.
is takes practice.
Yeah,
not used to doing it though.
I think it takes a lot of teaching too, because like you said, a lot of people are not used to it.
Yeah,
and they don't know how to do it.
Yeah,
and like,
but if you let an apostle take charge like me, he's going to run over people. A lot of people are going to be hurt, so I listen to the pastor. But if I get impatient, I go, "Oh, come on! Do we have to talk about every single possible way this can hurt people?" And so the pastor needs a little bit of oomph from the apostle. We need, otherwise the whole body won't function.
Yeah,
we'll get nowhere fast. And a lot of times I find people who have multiple polycentric leadership, they turn it into flat leadership, and we never make any decisions. We just have a bunch of conversations.
Yeah.
That's a good distinction.
Yeah, we were even talking about that earlier today. It's just like, some people would have the criticism that mutual submission means nothing gets done, because everyone's just like, oh, like, we're just going to submit and nothing ends up moving ahead.
If nothing's getting done, you need the apostle in your group.
There you go. There you go.
Okay, the apostle will get very frustrated, say a few swear words, and then say, what the, you know what is going on here? Can we get on with it?
I like him, apostles. You mentioned a lot about like neighborhoods and like locality. Like, I take it that like it's very neighborhood focused, the ministry that you're involved in. I'm just kind of curious. How do you practice a lot of these ways of church in kind of what I would call like locationally schizophrenic?
Location specific?
Schizophrenic.
Schizophrenic.
Because I find that like in our city, people don't have a sense of place. They don't really. They don't really say like this is my place.
Yeah.
And so they kind of like you know, they say, I go to church over there,
yeah,
but I'm going to drive 20 minutes and I'm going to play over there.
Yeah.
But I actually live half an hour back there.
Yeah.
So how do you...
It's communal culture.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is a problem to be overcome. And I think, I mean, I don't know Toronto well enough, but Toronto, in some ways, I mean, I've spent time in Toronto, and sometimes it feels like Chicago. Like,
yeah, we're like the Twin Cities, I think.
Sister cities.
Sister, is it city?
Sister cities.
Yeah. Sisters.
I can't remember. One time I was thinking about moving here. This is about 7 years ago, and we spent on two different occasions. We spent like three, we meaning my wife, Max, my son, and I spent like 3 days here, and we hung out in various neighborhoods, and we were blown away by the stuff that goes on in neighborhoods here in Toronto. But church, for some reason, seems to go above that dynamic. So but I think the other day I said on Facebook something like, I think if we realize how incredible the experience is of living close to one another, like at my church, everyone lives within 7 or 8 blocks of one another. My son goes all the time to two other couples' homes regularly that have kids. I mean, it's an amazing experience. We engage all the neighbors and all the issues locally, and it's an amazing experience. And if I knew it was going to be this good, but if I knew, I think if most people experienced what I experienced, they would make it a priority in their lives, because it just makes life so wonderful, relational, empowered, supported, doing things together. It's amazing. But I think in the cases you're talking about, the first things I would do is I would locate everybody in their home. I would decentralize the church. We might still meet once a week on Sundays for a gathering to be in his presence, but I would locate everybody in a home. I would focus people locally in parishes, even if they have to drive a mile to be at somebody's home. That's better than driving 10 miles to be with people and feeling, you know, separated. And I would locate people and say, we have to... So we have a system at our church. We put people in home groups, but then we have a little thing that I'm actually pushing really hard. So far, I don't know how far we've got on it, but it's a little workout sheet. Where do you go? What do you do? Who do you hang out with? You know, kind of like charting where everybody spends every hour of every day. Finding a place where two or three can go and be present once a week to do, just to be present. Sometimes it's to do something like workout or...
The kind of like the half circle that you describe in Faithful Presence?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think we need to get our churches organized in that way, so everybody has a dotted circle and a half circle in their lives, and that the Sunday gathering is really part of a rhythm, but it's decentralized.
My follow-up question is this, like, how do you engage with people, and what does ministry look like for those who are becoming less physically present? And so, like, they may be just kind of withdrawing more, their whole life may be like social media or kind of like gaming or forums and such like that. Like, they're kind of withdrawing to more of a, like, the online world, the tech world. What does it mean to engage them when they have less and less of these third spaces in which they meet? You know, at a lot of restaurants, we'll see a lot of families, they'll be sitting around the table, everyone's on a device.
Wow.
They're withdrawing. And this is not only like families, but we're talking about just like people in general.
Chinese restaurants.
The Chinese
oh,
restaurants.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
The kids are on the iPads.
Yeah. Like, everyone has their own show. But I'm saying, like, there is this culture that's developing that people are more present and engaging online and not physically present. And so what does that look like moving forward for us as practitioners? And
how do you do Faithful Presence on the online gaming industry?
There you go. Hey, there you go. We're going to use the book title right there.
Are they
David
actually
Fitch, right here?
Are they really present, or they think they're present?
Oh, that's a good question too.
I have two comments. First of all, social media is good to a degree to accomplish minimal engagements. But there's so much coming out, especially in the last 6 months, on people who get trapped in this world, are in massive depression, and going nowhere in their lives.
Yeah.
So, church, use social media to disrupt and call people to something deeper. So, social media is good, I think. Social media really helps me.
You use it a lot.
I use it a lot. I use it to develop thoughts, have conversations, create spaces for developing and disrupting people's ideas. But it only goes so far. It cannot do the work of the kingdom in its redemptive ways that God wants to do apart from his presence. So it has to draw us into his presence. And I think most people will eventually understand that if you make a point of revealing it.
Sure.
That's why I use social media. But
hey, you know what? I watch like a movie like Ready Player One, and it's like people are gathering online. In fact, like they can be a different person online. They can have places of, or they can build meaningful relationships online. But then it lacks that physical.
Still a deep yearning and a longing, right?
Like, I mean, like
Dave, you talk a lot about Eucharistic life, right? And you can't do that in a virtual environment. You know, like I'm part of a Midtown Buns group, so it's kind of like a buy and trade group in Midtown Toronto. And all the time people are like, anybody at the pub tonight? Like, I'm at the table at the back if you want to just hang out.
Yeah.
Like, there's a longing.
For sure. It's
like they're longing for something physical, something tangible, right? Like, and I feel that in the city because there's so much going on. Still, you know, longing for something interpersonal, right? So
yeah, but it's easier for people to withdraw now too, right?
Could online, hopefully this is going to go too far, could online be the half circle?
Could it? Yeah,
I don't want to go
question.
Too far with
this
the,
is a good
you know, the illustration, but you could still make the contact in being, I guess, more physically present at, you know, as you invite to your table.
Sure.
Or even and at the close circle, but in a half circle, like where people are at, and if a lot of our people are at there, is it more divide and conquer? Let's kind of engage people. They have to be physically present over there, and then we can actually be there. Or is it online? Is actually, I don't want to get into this kind of weird.
Hey, it's an interesting idea, but my first stab at answering it is because of the distance that is assumed in social media conversations and the so-called masks and everything else. Antagonism is just a whole lot more prevalent. And so last night, I'm walking to Potbelly Bar. I say the Epiclesis prayer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm there, and this Palestinian Arab man, is sitting across from me. And we're just talking. And one thing leads to another, and I ask him about his first years in Palestine, in Jerusalem, actually, outside of Jerusalem. He goes on and on and on about religion being this place that divides. It's you're either a Muslim, a Jew, or a Christian, and everyone hates one another in Jerusalem, and it's terrible. He says, I want nothing to do with religion. At this point, I had not, you know, revealed that I'm a believer. And I said to him, I go, yeah, but. And I felt the presence of God. And I said something like, yeah, but we're more than just molecules, aren't we? Do you think we're more than just this flesh? He starts showing me pictures of his daughters and that he's divorced from his wife. And I go, that love there, that's more than just brainwaves, isn't it? And he goes, yeah. And because I think something happened there metaphysically in presence, that it couldn't have happened. I do not believe it could have happened online.
Hmm.
Because it crossed, it went from all religion sucks to, dude. And I just connected with him in a way that I don't think he could have trusted me online. If I would have said that, he would have said, oh, you're just arguing with me if I had been online.
he wrote a blog post, and he's going to respond to you. You should look him up. He was like, hey, I met this guy. Anyways, I think we got a couple more questions, and I think that'll be it for us. Did you want to ask your George question? I think that was a cool... Yeah.
Well, you know, as you're talking about this, you know, I hear a lot of your stories, and I've always been intrigued by, you know, you keep bringing up George at McDonald's.
George at McDonald's.
As you engage... I think on a very practical level, when I hear this, when I kind of let other people hear, you as going to McDonald's as a third space, as in the half circle, as you mentioned in Faithful Presence, buy that book on Amazon.com.ca, whatever.
Do it now.
There's a mini version.
There's a mini version too.
Seven practices now. Seven practices. Yeah. Okay, we're pitching you, man. But... All right, but with that, as you mentioned, you engaged George. I've found a lot of times I thought about it, it sounded, and I know I don't, you're not explaining the whole story, it sounds very individualistic. The engagement is just like, yeah, well, you had a great relationship with George and you built up over the years and whatnot. Did you bring people along with that in kind of like, you know, where does that communal mission come in, that demonstration of the kingdom?
Sometimes, especially if you're an apostle, you got to start things and you got to go there by yourself and pull people in with you. Even though I went by myself, I brought... the church with me. I know that sounds like maybe a rationalization.
Oh, man.
What happened soon thereafter was four guys eventually, but one dropped out. So it's three to four guys. We met in the back in the playland at McDonald's. We did our weekly men's group, and Tommy Maloney called me Pontius Pilate and the Nail Driving Five. That's what he called us. Okay. But they saw something. With more than just me, they saw us.
Yes.
And the way we interact, they saw something that was happening. At Potbelly Bar, I got three other guys that meet with me, but they're not always there. Patrick wasn't there last night. I was on my own. I texted them all, and I go, you wouldn't believe this conversation I had tonight. You missed it. Blah, 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 blah. So, but sometimes the more apostle types like me who know I've got to be out there, I've got to do it, I've got to show the way. That's what us apostles do. We might be there for alone for a while till we pull people in.
Sure.
All right. So, Adam, if we're going to end off, what's something encouraging you can offer to us, offer to people listening? I don't know.
I just think there's a ferment going on, and you know, don't get discouraged at the failures of large churches, their pastors and leadership, like we've just experienced in Chicago. Stay local, stay on the ground, cultivate the kingdom. I have a table fellowship every Sunday night at my place. I mean, that's more important than anything else I do. And, you know, our Sunday morning service is pretty great. But if you ask me to choose that table, that time around the table with each other, praying for one another and experiencing God on each other's lives and praying for our neighborhoods, that's just the basic core thing you can do to cultivate kingdom in your own life and then disrupt and bring that life to your larger church body. So just stay grounded, cooking away on the local level. Don't get discouraged by large, problematic structures. God will take care of that.
That's a good word.
I needed that.
This is awesome. All right. Thank you so much, Dave Fitch. Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much for...
It's great just being here. Drinking one beer, by the way.
Did you even finish the beer?
I did.
You did finish the beer. And any more belches just for the podcast?
No, that's rather...
All right. We're
CMA belch.
CMA belch. All right. You guys have been listening to the Canadian Asian Missional Podcast. Please... Please remember to subscribe and rate and review. We'd love to hear back from you.
Give these guys a review, will you, out there?
Hey,
Holslaw, if you're listening, give these guys a review.
Oh, there you go.
All right.
Yeah, Jeff Holslaw.
This is a test to see if Jeff's listening.
Shout out, yes. Hey, let us know how we can be engaging these issues and engaging them in better ways. And you can get in touch with us by Facebook or Twitter or email. Hey, thank you so much for joining us on this journey, and we hope to see you next time.
Peace.